Hello, I had a thought that I'd be able to meet you all kind of in person with your masks off, but we're going to have the big reveal hopefully sooner rather than later. So welcome everyone, especially if you're first time here tonight, then very warm welcome. And welcome also to the online people. We have a hybrid class tonight. So we're on the second class of this Beginners Foundation course. And the title is We Are All Sick. And I kind of like it because I'm a bit of a sicko myself, but please don't be offended by this title. And it's okay if you are offended, all will make sense soon. So it's a 10-week course. I'm the program coordinator here and I've been here for a couple of decades now. A lot of this course comes from kind of my own stumbling experience of trying to then be a bridge between kind of modern life and having an interest in Buddhism and where to get started and what the really crucial parts are for us to take on board, especially as beginners. What we've already covered, so we've had our first class, but it's okay if you didn't come to that first one. We're continuing on with a theme. So mostly we looked at what a valid refuge is. So how we kind of seek a refuge. We seek help or solace or protection, especially when we're down and when we're vulnerable. And so our go-to refuges can be things like Tim Tams, can be serial relationships, can be just sleep, can be politics or art or sport or all sorts of things, family. And we really are thrown back on our own resources when things change, especially times now, like with COVID and lockdowns and all sorts of things, to question what our refuge is. So we looked at what makes sure that a refuge is going to be reliable and actually help us and not lead us astray. So for those of you who were here last week, does anyone remember, did anything stand out to you about that, about finding out how to tell if something was going to be an okay refuge or not? Cast your mind back all that time ago. Yeah, thanks, Jinx. So looking at your past experience, seeing does it work? So really checking it out, not taking things on blind faith. We also looked at what our goals can be. So our goals can be, for just now, we just don't want any problems now. We can also think, well, at the very least, we don't want things to get worse. We don't want our life to end up worse than it is. We want it to end up better. But once we start thinking, what happens next? What happens at the end of this life? Is there anything after this life? Was there anything before this life? Then we kind of embark on a spiritual path. And I think there's also a bit of a grey area there that then we're thinking, well, what comes after us anyway in the world? Like, what kind of legacy are we leaving as human beings? So from a Buddhist point of view, the aim for oneself, instead of just going around and around in cyclic existence, becoming reborn again and again, going up, going down, to strive for nirvana or liberation, which is liberation from all problems and sufferings. And how it's possible, because if we remove the causes, then you can't have the result. You remove the causes of suffering, you can't have the result of suffering. So freedom, otherwise known as nirvana. And then there's more though. So from a Mahayana Buddhist point of view, our aim can be actual Buddhahood or enlightenment. And so how that's not something kind of foreign that only happened in the olden days or only happens to Asians or only happens to blokes, but it's actually if we remove all of our negativity systematically bit by bit and develop all of our strengths and our potential, eventually the outcome is enlightenment. It's a natural progression. So we're going to explore that theme a lot more, especially in the class when we come up to about the mind. So what we'll have a look at today,
We're all sick.
I didn't put we're all sickos. I just put we're all sick. And we can almost think of it as we're sick of it all in a way, isn't it? And we are sick of it all, well and truly. So there are real benefits to recognising ourselves as sick. And one of the great benefits, of course, is it's much better to see ourselves as in a state of disease or illness rather than fundamentally bad or broken. So from a Buddhist point of view, we're not bad by nature. All of our suffering and our problems and everything comes because we're sick. And, you know, the sickness is the disturbing emotions. And, you know, once we kind of see it like this and see how it's kind of a spectrum that goes up and down, then we can do something about it. So that's what we're looking at today. And what that means is how do we apply the teachings in daily life? Because you might be really curious about things, but it's not enough just to understand, is it? Because we can really understand why we get depressed or anxious, but it doesn't help our depression and anxiety. We need to know actually what we can do. And then we've got this great analogy of the three cups or the three vessels. So how to avoid contaminating the teachings, or how to avoid misunderstanding things. And especially when we have teachings from a culture that's been quite different from our own, a lot is lost in translation culturally. And we take a lot of our cultural baggage with us that we don't even know that we do it. And I noticed this with myself because I was brought up a Buddhist. So I thought, I don't have any of that Judeo-Christian hangover in my life. And yet there's still a lot of that there that I've noticed. And it's kind of surprising. And it's just because it's a cultural thing that we have. So to head off a whole lot of potential problems at the past, so that you don't have to kind of get tangled up like that. Let's start just with a short reflection to set our motivation. First, settling your posture so that your spine is kind of straight, your posture is alert, but that you're also comfortable. So just straighten your spine and then notice if there's any areas of tension to release the tension. Sometimes if you have a lot of tension in your shoulders or your neck, if you squish your shoulders up trying to touch your earlobes, tight, 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 and then let them drop. Hands just in the lap or on the knees. Make sure you're not tipping to one side or the other. Try and be relatively symmetrical. Become aware of your presence where you're sitting, how the seat supports you. There may be noises going on around you, but we're still and quiet where we're sitting. And bring your focus to the breath. Just become aware of breathing in and breathing out. And just like we settle our posture, then we can settle our mind. So just having your attention anchored on the breath. Anything else that comes into the mind as it arises, let it go. As if any of those distractions, they're normal, you don't have to squeeze them out. You don't have to try and suppress them. Just leave them in the periphery. And instead have your focus being aware of the sensation of the breath as you breathe in, as you breathe out. If you have any thoughts arising, just Name them as thoughts without getting involved. If you have feelings or emotions arising, again, recognize them as a feeling or an emotion without getting involved. And as our inner environment begins to settle down, just like autumn leaves come to rest once the wind has stopped, then allow the main reason for you being here to come to mind. What was it that brought you here tonight that you want to find out about or fix, solve, develop? And then think how, if you do those things, if you have success, how that will benefit not just yourself, but everyone around you. How you can help change the lives of others for the better, contribute to others' happiness, make less harm in the world. And then we can go even further and think everything that we learn and contemplate and question can develop our own good heart and our own wisdom without limit, all the way to enlightenment for the benefit of all. So we can make our reason for being here really extensive. So with this motivation that includes oneself and includes also the benefit of others, then gently bring your focus back to the room. So our topic, we are all sick. So when the Buddha gave teachings, it took a while before he gave any teachings because when people first asked, you know, how come there is this glow about you? How come, you know, you're free? He basically said, to paraphrase, like, if I told you, it'd blow your mind. And so it took a while before he actually gave teachings. And so the teachings that the Buddha gave weren't just kind of philosophical musings, but they were specifically to help us out of suffering, to help us with problems. When we approach the Buddha's teachings, it's a lot more than academic study. And I mean, that's why you come to a Buddhist center for Buddhist teachings rather than go to a university, because university, you get the academic study for sure. But what we need is the experience in our life. We need to actually feel the change within our life. So our approach can be to take it as personal instructions of something to be applied in our everyday life. And, well, why would we even take these personal instructions? Well, because we're sick. We're sick of it all. And viewing ourselves as sick within it has this idea that it's possible to become well. Dis-ease, you know, it's being out of kilter. So what we are mostly sick with is the disturbing emotions. They make us sick. So disturbing emotions, the obvious ones that we know about, jealousy, hatred, extreme craving and covetousness, kind of associated ones, extreme frustration that can develop into malice and hatred, fears that can develop into real kind of closed-mindedness and prejudice, all sorts of mistaken ideas about ourselves, mostly how we underestimate our potential, that can develop into really low self-esteem. Jealousy, being unable to rejoice when at least other people are happy. At least somebody is. So all of those disturbing emotions, we might not have them manifest all for us here and now. You know, we're relatively calm sitting in a nice Buddhist center, but they're kind of there latent. And we know we've got disturbing emotions because we have the evidence of them. Unhappiness, boredom, angst, depression, anxiety, they're all symptoms. They're all like when we have a fever and achy bones. We know we've got something. I've picked up a virus. Hopefully not the big one. So even though the disturbing emotions can manifest in different ways, so we might have different symptoms, these kind of disturbing emotions that we have are universal problems, and they're not just olden day problems or not just modern day problems. They're kind of a universal thing. And so of course we try all sorts of ways to overcome them, and to varying degrees of success or not. And often we compound it by thinking, I'm feeling so terrible, I must be a terrible person. Or I'm feeling so bad, I must be a bad person. Or things have gone wrong, I must have done something really bad. So we compound our problems and suffering with guilt and judgment and beating ourselves up inside. Very rarely when we have a problem do we have an inner voice that's encouraging, is it, or compassionate. Usually just gets even worse. So at least if we think of ourselves as being sick instead of bad, then there's much more likely that we'll feel compassionate, that we'll take a compassionate attitude to ourselves. And when other people are manifesting the disturbing emotions or the results of them, instead of getting really hateful back at them, we'll more naturally have a sense of compassion or genuine care. Wow, what's gone wrong? They must have had a terrible day to be acting like this. So I have a little something to read to you from The Buddha's Medicine for the Mind, Cultivating Wisdom and Compassion. So it's by the Australian Geshe Tashi Sering, and he says, the desire for happiness is common to us all. Everyone wants to be happy, but various circumstances prevent this. Why do we encounter frustration and unhappiness instead of the deep and lasting happiness we seek? Could there be a cause, or do happiness and unhappiness just occur randomly? Unhappiness is like a side effect of an illness. If the illness is properly diagnosed and treated, the side effects disappear. Recognizing this, the Buddha diagnosed the illnesses that lead to unhappiness and prescribed a cure for them. And the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, are the Buddha's medicine for the mind. The Buddha knew from experience that unhappiness is a product of disturbing emotions, and these emotions have a negative effect, a negative influence on our state of mind, and cause us to act negatively. And the Buddha realized that if we could uproot disturbing emotions, we would uproot the causes of unhappiness and plant the seeds for true happiness. But as we might expect, the remedy for unhappiness doesn't come as a pill. If we want to achieve total physical health, we must follow a complete regimen of eating the right food and exercising and seeing a doctor. And similarly, to achieve deep and lasting happiness that is free of all suffering, we must also have a comprehensive program. We must learn what causes our unhappiness and how to overcome it, and what causes happiness and how to encourage those things. And finally, we must internalize what we learn and apply it in our life. So last week when we talked about what a Buddhist is and how a Buddhist is an inner being, someone who looks within first for the fundamental causes of how of our experience, whether we experience happiness, unhappiness, problems, there's all what's going on around us, but how we experience them depends on us. So if we don't, as long as we don't recognize that we're sick, and if we blame the external circumstances for our suffering, then we'll never become free. So there's kind of like this terrible bargain that we make, And I know it in myself. I want to be able to blame somebody else or something else. But the moment we do, then we can't do anything about it. We've just given away all of our power. So if we look a little closer, we'll see that, yeah, all of the circumstances, the things that happen to us definitely play a part in how we feel. But the crucial thing to how we feel and how we experience things is us. So we can't blame the external circumstances fundamentally. And, I mean, the proof of it is that all of us can be in the same situation and we'll all respond differently. So it can't be the situation that's the main cause. It's kind of like a condition. It contributes, but the main cause is within us. So that's what Buddhism's all about, looking within us. And then not to blame ourselves and think, oh, well, I must be terrible or bad, but to see it as a sickness, something that we can become healed from. And actually, from the Buddhist point of view, if we can heal ourselves, then we can help to heal others. And just like if we've gone through our teenage years and managed to survive them just, and if you've got a younger brother or sister or a niece or a nephew, and now they're entering their teenage years and your eyes are rolling and just thinking, oh, you poor thing. But if you've been through it, you've got something that you can share to help. And it has an incredible effect on the world too, because if we remember that everybody who acts badly or destructively or maliciously only does so from a point of view of suffering. No one ever acts like that when they're at peace in their own mind. So then instead of meeting hatred with hatred or bigotry with bigotry, we'll be able to meet it with a really like informed compassion. So not being kind of in denial, but also recognizing what's happening, but with a heart full of care and concern. So that way we'll become kinder people, better people, better people to be around, and we won't compound the problem. So often I think all of us, we're just like kiddies at a birthday party having had too much red cordial, you know, we're running around and it's fine for a while and then suddenly, you know, someone's going to be crying really soon and you're just waiting for it. You're waiting for the crash and the cry. But you don't kind of say, those evil kids, they're so bad. You might kind of feel it, but you know it's not true. You know, it's just that they've driven themselves insane with too much sugar. Okay, so let's just do a little reflection just to see how this applies to us. So settle your posture again and bring your mind inwards. You can still keep your eyes open, that's okay. It's kind of like a like when we're reading, you know, our eyes are looking outwards, but our focus is inwards. And just think about the last time that you got sick. Might have been a stomach bug or a flu. And when you think back to when that happened, just as you're getting sick, you know, that thought, oh, I hope I'm not getting sick. What was your first step? What did you do? Did you do anything? Were you just in denial going, no, 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 not happening? Did you immediately jump into action, take vitamin C, have a rest? Did you just barrel on, getting tighter and more grumpy? Did you have to keep on going to work? So now think, as the disturbing emotions arise in our mind, the inner contagion of hatred or attachment and craving and dissatisfaction. When we become overwhelmed by our negative states of mind, what's our first response? Do we just soldier on and keep going through our life and spread our contamination to everybody? Do we quickly take an antidote? Do we put ourselves into isolation and take care of ourselves kindly? Have we ever just kept on going until something broke, till we had a nervous breakdown, or till we fell over and broke a bone and had to go to bed, till we had a huge argument that we regretted? And continuing with this reflection, just like if we feel we're getting sick, who do we go to for help? And do we just consult Google God, or do we make sure it's reputable sources that we consult? And for our emotional and spiritual well-being, who do we go to for help? So just like we aspire to have a healthy diet and exercise and keep our immune system strong, so too, to end this reflection, make a determination in your mind to keep your inner immune system strong, your tolerance and patience for others and yourself, to put some effort into the emotional and spiritual fitness of our inner world, our experience, and how we relate to others. And again, just gently bring your focus back to the room. So we can see, like, just with COVID and when you've got various different strains of it, how it can spread like wildfire. The same thing can happen with our emotions, can't it? Just can be one rude person, a stranger, and it can ruin your whole day, and then how you react to everybody else ruins their day, and so it goes on. So it's a very handy analogy here. So the Buddha, the teachings that the main teaching that the Buddha taught, known as the Four Noble Truths, or the Four Truths kind of in accord with reality. And the reason that we have inner instability or sickness is because we have this resistance to reality. We just want things to be in one way and we have a real resistance to it, or we get it mixed up. So I'm just really paraphrasing here the Four Noble Truths. But the first one really is to do about recognizing suffering, that, and it's called true suffering, recognizing that there are problems and there's the obvious suffering, but there's also the less obvious suffering. So if someone's sick, or if someone's broken a bone, or if someone's got kind of cancer, it's obvious and we have a natural response of compassion. But if we look around now, you know, we might just think, oh, well, everybody here is okay. But hey, how do we know? There's a whole lot of inner turmoil as well. There's also suffering that comes when things change from going along okay to turning into disaster. So from Buddha's point of view, that's actually what's called contaminated happiness or unstable happiness. And most of our happiness is that, isn't it? It's unstable. It depends on whether we're in lockdown or not, on whether we have our freedom or not. It's actually what His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls the suffering we run towards. Because it's fine for a while, but then it turns into its opposite. And every time we're surprised. If you've ever overeaten really delicious takeaway food, you know what I'm talking about. The other type of suffering, there's a third type that is kind of the suffering of our day-to-day existence. Just how much effort it takes to go through each day, life maintenance, looking after our body, getting enough sleep, you know, cooking and cleaning and eating, all of those things, and how the nature of our existence comes along with suffering. The fact that we have a body means that it's going to feel pain, means that we're going to get sick. The fact that we have our disturbing emotions means that we react in ways that are unfortunate, and then we get the results, and then we have more disturbing emotions. So that's kind of called compounded pervasive suffering. So that's the nature of our existence. And many times when people have a realization about this, and it often can happen when you have suicidal thoughts, you can have a real insight into the nature of our suffering, but then we stop there. We kind of just get stuck on that and then fall into nihilism, despondency, and despair. But there's three more truths to go. So in a way, if you have had a really dark night of the soul, those kind of suicidal thoughts, instead of kind of trying to pat yourself on the back and go, there, it's not that bad, actually own it for what it is and go, it is that bad, but there's more. Don't just stop there. Other people have had this, including the Buddha, and he went further. So the next thing was that it's not just random, that there is actually a cause. Anything that we experience necessarily has a cause. And just because we can't pinpoint what it is doesn't mean there is one. So it doesn't mean it's random. Doesn't mean it's out of our control. There is a great relief to being able to name the illness, to name the diagnosis, to find out, oh, wow, I've got ADHD. That's why I've had so much difficulty. Or I've got this particular disease. Now I know why things have been going wrong. To actually find the causes for those things. So the same thing for the nature of our existence. There is a cause. And the cause of our suffering can never be out there. The main cause is within our own mind. And that's great because that means we can do something about it. Everything else we can think of as a trigger. So we need to get the correct diagnosis. And if you've ever had the wrong diagnosis for something, this can be quite catastrophic. If you've got the wrong diagnosis for a mental illness or a physical illness, then even if you are incredibly sincere and put everything in place to try and fix it, it's not going to help you. So we need to diagnose it right. So the other two truths that ending suffering is possible, wellness is possible. We can think of it as a state of optimal flourishing. What's enlightenment? A state of optimal flourishing. So this is true cessations. That it, because once we understand the nature of our mind, that the nature of our mind is pure, therefore it's possible to remove all of the contaminants, all of the disturbing emotions, all of the confusion. And if we remove them, then there's no more suffering. So that's possible for every living being. All living beings have this potential. And thank goodness there is a method. There is something that we can do. So the Buddha taught what are called true paths, many different methods to overcome suffering for many different dispositions. And actually, the method to train our mind out of suffering and putting in place the causes of happiness, I reckon is easier than going to the Olympics. I look at how much effort the athletes put into training and how they get up when it's dark and they do all of that training, and then they go to work and then they come home, and everything that they eat and what they talk about and everything for 4 years in a row, every single day for this one event. If we put that kind of effort into becoming enlightened, it would be easier. We don't necessarily have the potential to win a gold medal, but we definitely have the potential to become liberated and enlightened. So, any questions or comments so far? Anything at all about this very quick look around the Buddhist world? So it's a translation from Sanskrit. So it's called the Four Truths of the Aryas, or the Arya beings, or the Noble Ones. So those who see reality directly, clearly, without distortion. Yeah. So it's kind of a bit of an archaic word to use. The Aryas who directly see reality instead of through all the various lenses and distortions and baggage that we have. So they're called the noble beings, or the noble ones. So when we're living in accord with reality, then of course the result is going to be happiness. So how do we put this into practice? The teachings as a personal instruction? Okay, so the first one, seeing the Buddha as a doctor who's diagnosed the illness within himself and then prescribed a cure from his own experience. So not a cure from some wonderful theory that you've made up because it fits a nice acronym, a cure that's actually been tried and tested. So the Buddha didn't give teachings explaining everything in the universe. When did time begin, or all of these different mathematical things? The real teachings of the Buddha are about how to end suffering. Now, if we go to the doctor, if we're ill and we go to the doctor, we might be tempted to, but we don't say, "Doctor, fix me." It's actually not the doctor that fixes us, is it? It's the doctor that gives us the advice what to do. And then how many of us follow the doctor's advice? Like, I remember when I broke my ankle and then I had to go to the physio and then, you know, I had to do these boring exercises. Well, I didn't do them. So then I had a weak ankle for the next 4 years and kept on breaking it. So, you know, we want the doctor to fix us. But as we know, the doctor can't do it for us. But still, we need a really good doctor, and we need a doctor that we trust and that has a good track record and that can actually heal. That's not just a theory. So the second one, then the Dharma. The Dharma is the medicine. And so we internalize the teachings by applying them to ourselves with regular practice. So I remember reading a story about a country Russian doctor, and somewhere in Siberia, they haven't had a doctor there for ages and ages, and so he's setting up his clinic and various people come in and they're sick, and he gives them the antibiotics to have, and everyone's going along for quite a while, and then suddenly they're all on death's door at the same time. Their health has plummeted. He's like, what's been going on? So what happened was they were taking the antibiotics every day, and after about 3 days they went, oh, I'm really bored with this, and they took all of them at once. So there is a lot in following the instructions. It's really worth to make sure that we follow the instructions, and just like with vitamins or if we get medicine, it's actually literally internalize a little bit every day. So again, it's like we can't just go to one Buddhist course and cram it all in and then expect a fantastic result. We actually have to integrate it into our life systematically, every single day, bit by bit. The other thing too is that often we just look for the yummy medicine. Has anyone here ever had Chinese medicine? You know, the boiled up herbs? Hairs on my arms just stood up. So, yeah, I grew up on Chinese medicine. And it did work. It actually fixed my asthma that I had as a child really terribly. But as a child, I hated that medicine, loathed and detested it. So not all medicine is yummy or palatable. And often when we're first embarking on this inner journey, we look for what we agree with and what we like. And sure, there is a resonance that happens. But it's important that when you get to something that's a little bit more challenging, to not just chuck it out, to actually apply it and see, does it work? And have the fortitude to do that. And the other thing too is that it's kind of like what we often do, collect a whole lot of prescriptions and display them all nicely on a shelf. You know, it's like, here's all my Dharma books, or these are all the courses I've been to. But have we actually gone and got the prescription filled and taken it? So if we read a whole lot of books and listen to CDs and get on teachings on YouTube, but we still can consistently have arguments with our family, or we're still kind of just really mean and short with people with our speech, then we know something's gone wrong here because our behaviour hasn't changed. Years ago, we had a really incredibly intelligent student coming. She was a university lecturer, and she'd come to some of the classes and then pulled me aside and said, oh yeah, you know, I've read that book on the Four Noble Truths and this book on the Lam Rim. Do you have anything more advanced? And it was almost like her intelligence was a curse, because it stopped her from realizing that it's not just more and more intellectual knowledge that we need here. Actually, once you start trying to apply it, you want something way more simple. I feel it's so important to get this one early on, to really, everything that you read, especially with the Buddha's teachings, in your mind think, how would I apply that to my life? How do I apply that to my relationships? How does that fit in with my own experience? And really make it a habit to personalize it. Otherwise, we can become more and more intellectually advanced and know all the lists of this and that and philosophical viewpoints and whatever, but still be miserable. And there are Buddhists like this around that are incredibly academically studied, and they're miserable. And I'm like, how can this be? All right, and the third one, the Sangha are the nurses. So they help us break the teachings into palatable sizes. So when you're really ill in hospital, who can remember which pills to take when? So that's what the nurses are there for. They come and they deliver it in doses, and they remind you. So our day-to-day Dharma teachers and the lamas that teach us at the moment online, they break the huge amount of the Buddha's teachings into these palatable bits. So during the pandemic now, for the last year and a bit, just about everyone's been teaching on thought transformation teachings, which is turning adverse circumstances into the path to enlightenment, because that's what we need. That's the medicine for our time. Transforming problems into happiness. And I like this image too, like as a baby, because often we'll say, oh, don't be a baby, and it's a derogatory term. But actually we are. Babies are vulnerable and they're new. And we're new to an inner life, to the spiritual path. And we're vulnerable and we don't know what to do. We get overwhelmed by all of our disturbing emotions and problems. So we need help. We don't know how to help ourselves. We're often like babies, we're just screaming, going, I can't bear it, and we don't know what to do. So we need someone to remind us, and we need Dharma buddies to remind us. I mean, the other thing too with the Sangha, the nurses, our monks and nuns, the lamas, our spiritual peers, all of us here, we've got to remember to ask for help too. And often when things go wrong, we kind of tend to hide ourselves away and be a bit shy about asking for help. And that also deprives our friends of being able to help us. We forget that. The other thing that I've noticed with the teachings online, these thought transformation teachings, is that I go to the ones on Sunday nights with Geshe Zopa. It's there on our calendar. And he's so kind and he's so encouraging. And the more adverse the topic, the more he cracks jokes and giggles and laughs, he makes it really palatable. So let's have another reflection then. So I'm not sure if you've ever been to have surgery. You may know someone who's had surgery, or you might watch the surgery shows on telly like I do. But if we needed life-saving surgery, what's the criteria of finding a good surgeon? Who do we place our faith in? So when we're looking for the qualities of a doctor, we're looking for really specific things, aren't we? There are some things about a doctor that really matter. We want them to have steady hands, to have their degrees from a reputable institution, that they have a good track record, that they've actually successfully operated on other people. Doesn't necessarily matter whether they speak the same language as us. Doesn't matter if we have the same taste in music. We may even have differing political views. And we want to have confidence that our doctor or surgeon is impartial, has real professional ethics, isn't under the sway of some other company, drug companies. So the same thing when we look for a spiritual teacher. We're looking for particular characteristics that they can lead us out of suffering. And there are some things that it doesn't matter whether they can do or not. Often when we're looking for a spiritual teacher, we might be looking for a nice, slick delivery, something that we like. But we want to really investigate. Is it a reliable doctor, a reliable source of information? And the medicine, well, what qualities do we look for in medicine? And how do we know if a medicine has worked, and how much time do we give it? And so too with our inner journey, how much time do we give it for change to happen? And are we consistent in trying to apply it in our life? And the helpers, the sangha, the nurses. What is the company that we keep? What happens to us when we spend a lot of time with angry or negative people? How do we react to them? How do we react after we've seen them? And what happens when we spend time with kind people, with wise people, with people we want to emulate, become like? So just like we owe it to our own health to find a good surgeon and not end up on a show like Botched, so too we owe it to ourselves to be really serious about our spiritual practice, our inner journey, and not cut any corners. So to end this short reflection, make a determination in your mind to really investigate thoroughly and to then have the confidence that we can get better, that wellness is possible. And then you can gently bring your focus back to the room. So I do spend a lot of time watching Botched and Botched Up Bodies and all of those ones, because it continuously astounds me that people will go to like Mexico for getting a cheap boob job and then be really surprised at what the results are. And it's like we're own worst enemies, and it's because the promise of something doesn't accord with reality, so get into trouble. And the same thing can happen on a spiritual path. So this leads us to then faith. So actually in Buddhism, having just blind faith is really discouraged. Just believing in Buddhism is discouraged. Actually, what we want to develop is a sense of confidence. So just like we don't believe in science, we kind of either know a bit about science or don't. We don't believe in maths. It's just something that we can use. So the same thing with our faith in Buddhism. The Buddha said, come here and see, which means, you know, come and check it out. So this is what His Holiness says in the introduction to Buddhism for Beginners. It might be useful if I mention here a few words about what our approach to Buddhism should be. In the beginning, one should remain skeptical and rely on questioning and checking the teachings based on one's understanding. One can then have trust and confidence in the teachings. The Buddha himself suggested this approach when he told his followers to accept his teachings only after due analysis and not merely out of respect or faith. Hence, it is important to know that the main cause of faith is reflecting on reasons. And this will promote conviction and help us develop actual experience. So I really like this. It gives me a lot of confidence. So we have clear faith from the Buddhist point of view actually can better be translated as confidence. So it's a result of having done your research. Just like if you do your research for a surgeon, you can go, yep, this one's the best one in Queensland. And so you have confidence instead of just going, I hope this one's the best one. If we develop this kind of faith, it means the more that we question, the clearer things become. So I really encourage you to question things, rather than being scared of it, you know, because under questioning, something falls apart, that's good riddance. Under questioning, something should become clearer. Of course, we've got to learn how to question things properly. I certainly wasn't taught how to do that at school, how to actually go methodically question something, but at least to have the courage to have really constructive doubts and to keep on asking, keep on discussing. So then the second type of faith that arises from that's called wishing faith or aspiring faith. So based on that kind of confidence, then we become motivated, eager to attain the same qualities as the Buddha, as those that have followed the Buddhist path. And through our own experience, we see, oh, they've done it, I can do it too. So we just know in our day-to-day life, don't we? Somebody just like us achieves something extraordinary, then we think, wow, if they did it, I can do it too. So that gives us an impetus to keep going, because we need to have a motivation to get through the difficult bits. It's not just all a hard slog. We need to actually be inspired to think it is possible, so it's worth it. When I first came to Queensland, my mother, who started this centre, she was diagnosed with cancer, and she died within about 3 months, and I kind of inherited the centre. Big shock. So she was about 71 when she died, and I'd come up to Queensland to kind of look after her, and she had a computer. So this was back in the day before computers, and I didn't have a computer. I thought, my gosh. My 71-year-old migrant woman mother has a computer. Surely I can learn how to use a computer. So it was that long ago that I came to Lunbury Tumba Centre. It was even before email. And also when I learned to drive really late in life as well, and it was a friend who needed to have those extensions on the pedals because it's a short person. I thought, well, if she can learn how to drive with those extensions, then I can do it. And then the admiring faith that comes from that is where you're just like when you've decided on a course of action and you go, yeah, that's right, and you kind of bask in the good feeling. This is what I'm going to do. You decided this is where I'm going to go on holiday, or this is what course I'm going to do, or this is where I'm going to invest my money, and you feel really good about it. But it's clear-minded because you've done all of this preparation and research beforehand. So you're clear and you're inspired. From a Buddhist point of view, this comes from really knowing what the qualities of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, are. So it's not just wanting to believe in Buddhism or hoping the Buddha will help you, but really understanding how it works, why it works, and why it's going to work for us. So it's a lot more like a scientific method than a belief system. And this kind of confidence then keeps us supported, keeps us with the energy to keep going. Over the years, I've seen a few people lose their faith. I've read books about people losing their faith within Jewish community, Jewish background, and within Christian background. But I've also seen Buddhists lose their faith, and I've thought, that's really strange. And it's because even though they've done lots of study, they've come along with this approach of belief. So we need to have a lot more than just belief. It's got to come from research and real confidence. So the reflection for this is just like if someone says, hey, trust me, I'll invest your money. How are you going to make your decision? What are you going to do? If someone comes up to you on the street and says, hey, trust me, I'll invest it on the ETF stock market thingy. Which just happens, right? We get the emails that say that. So what do? Some people reply to those emails, don't they? So why wouldn't we just hand over our money to someone on the street like that? Can we trust them? We don't know who they are. Their track record? Yeah, that's right. Where's the research? It's like those pyramid schemes, isn't it? It's like, here, buy my book on how to get rich. I'll make all the money with the book. Nobody gets rich. So I think last year, Australians lost $31 million to online scams. So that shows the depth of our belief, doesn't it? And it's because we're desperate. We so want something to work that we'll believe it. It's like through hope, it's blind faith. And we'll do it when an email comes and says, "You've inherited something from a long lost relative in Sierra Leone." And it happens to really good, intelligent people. So I read an article in the New Yorker magazine of a doctor actually who got caught by one of these scams. It might have been one to do with helping get somebody out of a terrible situation, stuck in a hotel. You might have got that one. I'm not sure if I got that one. My friend stuck in a hotel. She just needs $50 to get out of the hotel. So he sent the $50. And then they go, "Oh, that kind of worked. But now there's this other thing. Can you send $100? So he sent that. And then before you knew it, it was a couple of $1,000. So then he was invested in it intellectually and with his pride. So it was better to keep on sending the money and think it's legit than to cut your losses and go, "I've been sucked in." So $300,000 later, this well-renowned doctor in America finally kind of fessed up and said, "I'm in really big trouble here." So it happens. It happens because we're not aware how we invest our belief and our trust. So if it's happened to you, don't feel bad. It's a universal thing. It's harder to really investigate and to go against our yearnings and our wishes. So we have blind faith in worldly faith. We had faith in the stock market and yet it crashes. We had faith in real estate and it crashes. We have faith in this diet or that diet and then it doesn't work. We have faith in our parents and then we're disillusioned. So all of these worldly things, the suffering doesn't come from those things. It comes from our expectations that they're perfect, that it'll work. So I find it kind of embarrassing that, as a modern Western woman, I get sucked into these things just because of my hope. How did I come to my trust in the stock market or trust in this medicine or that? So if someone's going to ask us to invest money, we'd use our checklist from last week too of what a valid refuge is, and we'd investigate so we get some clear faith. What's their track record? What university did they go to? Are they themselves rich? What about their clients? And then we want the same results. So that's like the wishing faith. Then you think, "Oh, that'd be nice. I'd like to have the same results." So I've got some friends that have bought land just next to a national park just to extend. So they've got this whole system. This is what I want to do with my money. This is how I'm going to contribute to the world. It's still an investment. And then they think about it and feel happy. So that's like the wishing faith or the aspiring faith, that you feel good about what you've invested in. And it's something that you fall back on and supports you. Okay. So comments, questions? Have I scared you all off from Buddhism? Be good if I had. Yes. Yeah, so we're still in the era of the Buddha. So the Buddha is the role model that shows it's possible. This person applied the teachings and became well, became enlightened. So it is possible. So the living example of it. Yep, as a role model. And that it's not just a theory, but it's like evidence-based. So the Buddha Shakyamuni Buddha was like the historical Buddha, the teaching Buddha, but there have been many Buddhas since then because many people have applied these teachings to their own mind and got the results.
Who's defined as a Buddha?
Well, that's a tricky one because how would we know? If our mind is obscured, how can I tell who's a Buddha or not? So you've got your checklist too. You see, just like how do we tell if someone is a good person or not? Mm-hmm. So generally we check up with our own experience, and then we see with their peers, what do their peers say? And then what are their actions and what are the results of their actions? So there is a Buddhist joke that actually, I'm the last person on earth to become enlightened, and you're all Buddhas manifesting in front of me as students to make me hurry up and get there. Could quite possibly be true. So here we go. Now, avoiding the three faults. This is where we can get into trouble. The upside down vessel, the upside down cup, the dirty cup, and the cracked cup, the cracked vessel. So these are the ways that we can get into trouble when we're listening to the teachings or reading. So the upside down vessel, that's really simple. That's like when you come to class and you fall asleep. So yes, you were there, but not very much went in. So I've been there. I've been there taking notes, and then I've looked and my writing's become really big and loopy. So that's the more obvious one, but also an upside down vessel is when we're closed minded, and that usually comes from academic arrogance where we think we're right, or a bit of cultural imperialism of just thinking the Western modern viewpoint is perfect and unassailable, and actually it's not unified, it's not coherent, and there's a lot of contradictions. So kind of the academic arrogance is the one that can trip us up. And what it means is we listen to the Dharma and we're just habitually skeptical instead of really questioning, instead of like curiosity. So we don't get the benefit of the questioning because we're closed-minded. So that one we can do something about fairly easily. The second one, the dirty vessel, this is a tricky one. This is where we bring our emotional baggage with us and our cultural background with us, and we don't even know. So we listen to the Buddha's teachings through all of these kind of veils and filters, and we end up hearing something else entirely. We have a whole lot of assumptions that we don't know that we have. Often when we first hear about Buddhist teachings, we try and find equivalencies within, say, Christian culture. We hear about Buddha and we think, oh, that's how's that equivalent to God? Or we hear about Buddhism, we go, how is that equivalent to science? So we try and find the similarities. And some things there are equivalencies for sure. So the teachings on compassion across all the traditions, massive equivalencies there. They do fit together. But there are other things like the teachings on karma that don't fit into our Western point of view. And if we don't know that we've got this kind of dirty cup thing happening, then we hear teachings on karma, for instance, and we think, oh, that's not fair. How can a baby die of some horrible disease and that's their karma? That's not fair. So it's kind of revealed in our mind through our speech and the sayings that we have. So if we find ourselves saying that's not fair, we know we've got a Judeo-Christian background coming at looking at karma, internal cause and effect, and the two don't match. So even though I was brought up a Buddhist, I found myself saying, that's not fair. So when we say that, what we are assuming is that there is a judgment, that someone has organized it or judged it or made it happen, an external force.
It's almost assuming that there is a being, somebody has done it, and then it's not fair. Whereas if you just go cause and effect, the flower comes from the seed, you don't go, well, that's not fair. So that's a really easy one to kind of pinpoint. Another one that I noticed where it happened was when people go, oh, it was meant to happen. I was thinking about that today. I think that's material determinism. Because it's meant to happen is almost this deterministic kind of approach to, you know, when Darwinism was first invented, that cause and effect is somehow predetermined. But actually, science has changed a lot since then, and so can we. So if you find yourself going, it's meant to happen, it's kind of a way of trying to console ourselves. But either there's scientific materialism there, or even though we say we don't believe in God, we still reckon that there's someone that's organized it. So we carry all of this into the Buddhist teachings and we don't even know. And then we hear about karma or the disturbing emotions and we just go off on a tangent. So I'm kind of saying all of this because if you find that you're reading about things and you're feeling worse and worse, it may not be that what you're reading about is wrong. It might be that there's an assumption in there. Somebody else I remember was saying, yeah, I've been trying to develop compassion and I just get more and more and more miserable. And her assumption was that compassion was empathy, that you look at someone suffering and you feel for them. So if that's all we do, if we just have a crying puppy in front of us for 6 hours, we're going to be emotionally wrecked. But that's not compassion. That's empathy. That's feeling. That's like mirroring what's happening and feeling what they're going through, their suffering. Compassion is an activity. Compassion is this urge, I am going to help. So the moment we have an activity, we have agency, we're doing something about it, we get all of our energy and we're not overwhelmed just by the empathy. So this poor woman had mixed up empathy and compassion and, of course, just got more and more depressed and then went, I'm not meditating on compassion anymore. It's no good. So then missed out on all of that energy that we can get to really help others. So that blew my mind. When I thought about that, then it made a lot of sense. Was what happened with my own experience too. So the dirty vessel, tricky. Oh, that's right. The other one. Often when we talk about love and attachment, they're all mixed up together. And even the word attachment, like in Western psychology, we talk about attachment therapy as a good thing. In Buddhism, we talk about attachment as a bad thing. So what are the definitions? If we're using the same word and we're using totally different definitions. So the good thing is we can wash that coffee cup out. We don't have to make our coffee taste disgusting because we haven't washed the coffee cup out. We can clean it up. And then all the dharma that gets poured in, it's going to be delicious. The cracked vessel, that's fairly simple too. That's like if in one ear, out the other. There's many, many studies about how we can retain information. You know, after this class tonight, if you just go home and look over your notes tonight, then your short-term memory starts turning into your long-term memory. It can be that simple. Doing study and review, which we're only going to do if we enjoy it. And how are we going to enjoy it? Because we've got that faith based on confidence. So we like splashing around in this material. We can't wait to get back to it and read a bit more and think about it and think about how does it apply here and how does it apply there, and it's infinitely fascinating. So if we don't become really familiar with the material, what happens is that we've heard the teachings, we go, yep, that all makes sense. And then some disaster happens in our life and we don't know what to do because we forgot everything. The heat of the moment, we kind of panic and we can't remember any of the Buddhist stuff that we've ever heard about what to do. And perhaps just revert back to, you know, old habits. So what to do? Number one, remember to enjoy your study, savor the journey. Then we'll be there for the long term. I remember Geshe Zopa said when he was there in the monastery that there were some really incredibly intelligent, fantastic students. They'd study all the time. Even when they're doing their chores in the kitchen, they'd have a book there, they'd be studying. They were acing their classes and everyone's saying, oh, they're going to go far. They're going to be fantastic Geshe's and teachers and whatever. And the older teachers there at the monastery went, oh, we'll see, we'll see. And actually, it's like they went too hard, too fast and blew a gasket. And so after 10, 15 years of study, tight mind, pushing, lots of ambition. It's not sustainable. It's not a lifestyle. Always in your mind, you're thinking at the end, it'll be better. Somehow we're going to get to somewhere and it'll be better. It's not a long-term view. It's actually much better to go along and enjoy the whole thing as a lot like we do with hobbies. With hobbies, we just potter along. When we get tired, we put aside. When we come back to it because we like it. We don't berate ourselves if we get it wrong. Oh, I did a wrong crochet stitch. We just go, oh, well, silly duffer. It's no big deal. We're much more encouraging. We have fun. We share it with others. So that's the approach that we can have too with our spiritual journey. Really nice, encouraging, sustainable. Don't try and understand everything all at once. So because I grew up on Buddhist teachings, I've been very used to, like, at the teachings of the Lamas, writing down every word they say. And then when I went to uni and my first uni lecture, I wrote down every word he said. And then I looked and I went, this is rubbish. Like, actually, it was only every 30 words that there was something important in there. It was a really big culture shock for me. So you come to Buddhist teachings, actually, there's so much in there and there's so many levels and so much in depth. You can feel quite overwhelmed, or things may be quite dry because it's very technical and we haven't got the joy of finding out about it yet, the experience of, hey, this works. So whatever teachings you go to, especially if it's teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Geshe Zopa or anyone like that, Geshe Saltram, who'll be coming here soon, to just listen out for that one gold nugget, the one thing, the one that you go, aha, that's the one that's going to help me, and then apply that. And all the rest, just think of it as washing over you and through you, landing somewhere in your mind that you can pick up later on. Practice in slogans, use your words, as your mummy might have said to you, use your words, dear. So in Buddhism too, we practice in slogans, we have sayings to remember, because in the heat of the moment when everything goes wrong, that's kind of all you can remember. You know, your mum might have said to you, just breathe and count to 10. Sometimes that's all we can do. Or not to retaliate, or to remember they can't help it. No one acts badly through happiness. They just act out through suffering. So these one-liners are often, when we're in extremis, when everything's gone wrong, that's what we hold on to. Other ones too, like in difficult situations, that everybody matters, like the Black Lives Matter. That's such a good thing because it's training in slogans. It reminds us, when there's a whole lot of violence and confrontation around, everybody matters, including Black Lives Matter. So we need those sayings because there's a huge amount that comes behind them.
apply the teachings to our own situation. And in my case, apply the teachings to my own situation before telling everybody else to change. And have Socratic questioning and follow-up. So to really figure out how to question things. So the kind of cause and effect questioning, almost like taking things to their absurdest, utmost extreme. If this, then this will happen. If that happens, then this happens. And take it to extreme and see, does it make sense? Different scenarios. Using our incredible imagination all the time to take the Buddha's teachings on and go, well, what if I applied that in my life? How would it affect me? How would it affect the cat? How would it affect the neighbors? So I hope this sets you in good stead. If at the beginning we get this right, then your spiritual journey will be just only beneficial. So this is just as a summary from Thupten Chodron, Open Heart, Clear Mind. The Buddha used the analogy of the three faulty pots to explain how to remove obstructions to learning. The first pot's upside down. Nothing can be poured inside it. This is analogous to reading Dharma books while watching TV. We're just so distracted, very little of what we read goes inside our minds. So she's got the different order. The second faulty pot has a hole in the bottom. Something may go inside, but it doesn't stay there. We may read the book with attention, but if a friend later asks us what the chapter was about, we can't remember. So that's happened to me over and over. Oh, yeah, the teachings were really good. They were really good. And then my friend says, well, what did Geshe Zopa talk about? I'm like, oh, you know. Trying to specifically find out what he talked about. So if I've taken notes, it's much easier for me to just remember. I don't necessarily go back to the notes, but I have that there to draw on in the future. And the third defective pot is dirty. Even if we pour fresh, clean milk inside and it stays there, it becomes undrinkable. This is similar to filtering what we read through our own preconceptions and ideas. We won't understand the subject correctly because it's been polluted with our own misinterpretations. And it is so tricky to set aside those misinterpretations because we don't even know that we have them. So that's why I just encourage you to keep on questioning. And my little go-to thing is that if despite being sincere and really trying to study, it still doesn't sit right and I still feel really terrible, then it's not that everything's wrong, it's just I'm missing a piece. So to keep searching. So in summary, there's great benefit to recognizing that we're sick. We can become our own therapist, just like the Buddha. In fact, there's a book by Venerable Robina Court and a course, Becoming Our Own Therapist. So just like we can't pray to the doctor to fix us, we have to do it. And Venerable Robina said, we can't get somebody else to sleep for us. We have to do it. Saying we can't ask God or the Buddha to do it for us. We have to do it, but we can do it. That's the thing. How? The Dharma is the medicine to take, to internalize and remember to ask for help. That's why we have a Buddhist center. That's why we have Dharma buddies. That's why we have teachers like Geshe Zopa and His Holiness, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Buddhism is not about belief, but confidence. So based on inquiry and our own experience. So work in progress and beware of our baggage. And Lama Yeshe often said, you know, be kind and check up. So check up, but not that horrible internal voice of being mean to yourself. Kindly.
Yes, come back next week because next week we're going to look at meditation. So this is, well, what do we do? How to meditate. What's meditation for? To get well. How to set up a meditation practice and different types of meditation. And then if you want to start, just a very simple, basic daily meditation. So it's a way of mind training, of turning our mind into this positive direction to get started. Yep. Because it can be really overwhelming. Where do I start? But also where we start is with the thing that's bothering us the most, the biggest problem, the one that causes us the most suffering. We start there, just like when we're ill, we don't go, oh, I just need to fix this. I'll start with this little ache and I'll leave the big stomach ache for later. No. You start on the big one. And so a course like this should be able to help you to know which of area of the Buddha's teachings to investigate and to start using the system, the advice. Yeah. So much as I'd like to put everything into one class. So during the week, just before we dedicate, during the week, just as an ongoing thing, notice if you have hopes or fears, and then just instead of freaking out about them or grasping onto them, just start questioning them, querying them. What are your hopes? What are your fears? What are they based on? What are their underlying assumptions? Is it a cultural thing, a family thing, something that's happened to you, a trauma thing? Just to become aware of it. Don't even have to do anything about it. It's just to become aware of it. We've all got those three cups there in our sink, so we just got to become aware of them. Let's dedicate the merits. Again, settling your posture and bringing your focus inwards. And firstly, feeling really happy of having invested the time. Far more beneficial than just investing money that can come and go. Investing in your own mind, in your own well-being, can have incredible benefit for you and for the world, for all living beings. So having put in the effort and the energy to getting here and then concentrating, really appreciate your efforts and your good-heartedness. And dedicate all of that to the biggest possible goal. Not just, oh, I hope I don't have so many problems next week, or I hope things turn out okay. But by everything that we've talked about, may we bring it to fruition. May we develop all of the realizations on the way to liberation from suffering and enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. So thank you very much, everybody, for...